Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. In this episode, we're talking about the top trade sales through Diamond to retailers for September 2019. Now, we've got the top 500 trades. When we talk about the breakdown, we're going to limit that to the top 300 because we got that going back a ways, and we can do apples-to-apples comparison there. But this is, again, what the publishers sold to Diamond, and miraculously, it's what Diamond sold to the retailers and what was invoiced for the month. So publishers may have sent more, hopefully have sent more to Diamond, so they've got ability to cover reorders or damages or whatever. But this is also not what the stores are actually selling to us, the end reader. That sort of point-of-sales information does not really exist within the direct market, and this, again, is the direct market. So, sales at conventions, sales at bookstores like Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Walmart or any other big brick bookstore that still exists would not count in here.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, as we talked about many times before, many comic stores are going through the same other distributors that those bookstores are doing to get returnability that Diamond isn't offering. It's still, though, a pretty good picture of what a large contingent of the sales is within the direct market, and the direct market does serve the hardcore comic fans. Mm-hmm. So I do think it is a controlling factor in, you know, what's going to come out, you know, 6 months, a year from now, etc. But it's good to know what the numbers mean and don't mean. So if we look at the breakdown for the top 300 trades, DC had the biggest number of units with 24.64% of the units. Marvel not all that far behind with 21.46% of the units, so about a 3% gap there. But man, if you do it by dollars, that gap really shrinks to 27.25% of the total retail dollars for DC, 27.19% of those same total retail dollars for the top 300 for Marvel. So like a 0.06% difference in the dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But part of that is because of a higher average price at Marvel, even though DC sold more units. So just kind of interesting how that was a almost even split between those two. Image then took 19.38% of the units, 16.96% of the dollars. And then we hit Dark Horse, which did a hair over 10% of the units with 10.01%, and then 9.1% of the total retail dollars. From there, it kind of, you know, drops off a bit with Viz doing well in the number of units with 7.18%, but because of a much lower average cover price, they only did 3.76% of the dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Which, honestly, not a bad approach for them to be taking, and one that has worked well for them and, frankly, the other manga publishers over the years. You know, smaller physical format, longer page count, and a lower per page price, it's hard to go wrong with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
We got a ton of other publishers on here, most of which are doing under a percent of the units and, you know, under half a percent or less of the dollars and such. But there's about twice as many publishers on the trades list as there was on the comics list this time around. And that's not too unusual. I think it's a little bit more of kind of a level playing field, or maybe a better way to put it is there's more opportunity for sales on the trade side than I think there are on the comics side for these smaller publishers.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and the honest truth is for the smaller publishers, you know, in most of the direct market stores, you're going to definitely see DC and Marvel taking up the majority of the shelf space, the rack space on the single issue side. And so, you know, that space being at a premium, the stores are much more likely to quickly move or only have a small amount of space for, you know, the non-big two. And you're going to therefore not have as much time on the shelf for the single issues. Whereas, you know, most of the stores that I've been into for the back catalogs or back issues or back collected editions of the smaller press stuff, they have a longer time to sit on the shelf and be available to sell. That's one of the biggest things is it's hard for someone to buy it if they can't see it, you know?
Yeah, if it's not on the shelf, you're not going to buy it. I think some of it also, though, comes down to with the smaller publishers, I think there's a bit more concern of, is this story going to get completed?
Yeah.
And that goes away when you buy the trade with the full story.
Yeah, that is very true.
So I know there have been a few publishers in the past I basically swore off in single issue format because they would abort to trade so often.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that was a non-starter for me because I was basically setting myself up to have to rebuy a large contingent of the series just to get that final chapter or two. If we go over and look at the top trades list itself, topping the list is Batman Damned hardcover with 11,352 units. This is actually a really good showing for the top of the list for not being like a Saga or a Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's going to get repeated with other Black Label hardcovers or stuff, don't know yet. Too early to tell. This is the first.
Yeah. And, you know, it's got a, you know, I think it's also good sales considering the price point, generally a little higher. You know, I think it is a few more issues than the normal. And DC usually is pretty good about pricing. But now, you follow the press a little bit more than I do. So this was the material that, quote unquote, got censored after the fact. The digital files got altered and the collected edition will not have the thing that caused the problems, right? Like they completely banished all that, right? So it's no longer available in any format.
That's my understanding. But by completely banish, all I really think they had to do was uh-huh. take one panel and just darken it a little. It was something that was, you know, particularly blatant or over the top.
Gotcha.
It's the kind of thing that maybe I'm just a lazy reader, but if it hadn't had such a big to-do about it, I'm not even sure I would have noticed.
Well, and you know how it goes in the comics industry. Or I should say the people that talk online about comics, it's always the Streisand effect. 99% of the time, no one would pay attention to half of it anyways until someone yells about it on Twitter.
There does come a point where sometimes a really big to-do comes about for not a whole lot of cause.
Yeah.
Other times, it is warranted, and I get it. So it's weird.
Yeah, and I understand. It's this this instance. I actually kind of understood some of the people's misgivings. Look, you have these two silos, right? You have this Black Label, which wants to be kind of Vertigo adult-esque, almost like the, you know. And I know this isn't imperfect because they have other aspects of the Black Label that I think they realized with how poorly Vertigo is doing. They're transitioning everything, but you know, kind of like the Marvel Max line. But Batman is such a central character and is such a gateway character for so many kids that a lot of times kids and parents don't know the difference. And they say, it's a Batman comic. Of course, it's okay for my 7-year-old. You know what I mean? And it's that's very difficult sometimes, you know, to parse.
I put that down as kind of the under-ruse rule. If kids' underwear is made licensed on these characters,
mm-hmm.
you really ought to think twice about doing a really edgy, hardcore adult story with them.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying you can't, mm-hmm. just saying, you know, think twice. I don't recall ever seeing underoos for like The Punisher.
Yeah, that would be interesting. You know, mom comes home with a pack of those from Target and then having to explain to her the history of the character. That would be pretty hard.
Just seeing some toddler with a skull kind of underoos on, it'd be just kind of weird. But I mean, that's the exact kind of inverse of what I'm talking about. You think that's not right to put on kids' underwear, you know? Yeah. Versus if it is, it's not right to be telling a really edgy, dark story with.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that you absolutely can't or whatever, but when you do that, you've kind of got to go a little overboard on the branding, on the retailer awareness, on the readership awareness, because as crazy as this sounds, and I'm pretty sure it happened this century, there was a retailer in Texas that got, I think, jailed for selling an adult comic to an adult.
Oh, geez.
The crime was the store happened to be near a school.
Oh, in the whole school zone thing, yeah.
Well, and of course, comics are for kids. Everyone knows that.
Oh, geez.
So there's a certain both self-preservation and probably paranoia is the best way to put it, that is wise to employ when you do stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the story they're telling in the Harley Quinn Black Label one, I guess it's Harleen or whatever, is a little darker, edgier, but I mean, that's a little baked into that character's origin in terms of the relationship with the Joker and all that kind of stuff. So it's a blurry line as to, you know, when do you cross it and when do you not, and how do you, is it okay or not? But again, the fact that was the most notable thing in terms of a unfortunate panel or whatever in Batman Damned being the most notable thing about the launch of the Black Label. That, I think, did more towards making it almost seem like an adult imprint than anything else, because I have yet to really get a good grasp as to what they think that Black Label is. Is mm-hmm. it creator-owned? Is it non-continuity stuff? Is it edgier stuff? Is it like the Max line, which is a very clear not-for-kids kind of a line?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's blurred for me, mainly because they also take a lot of stuff from the past and just kind of dump it in there. So I think DC has some major branding issues right now, and that just was front and center for a lot of it.
Yeah.
Next item on the list was Umbrella Academy Volume 3, Hotel Oblivion, 9,216 units. Again, with the Netflix series and stuff, not too surprising, this did pretty well. And it's good material.
Yeah, absolutely.
The next item was Paper Girls Volume 6 trade paperback, 7,907 units. This, I believe, might be the end of the Paper Girl stuff. Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Nope, this was the last issue. So I've kind of been interested in that. I think that there's this kind of trend where for the certain successful creators, you know, I think over the last 2 years, it's become more difficult to launch a series at Image for non-name creators that have already like kind of established an audience. You know, I think the Robert Kirkman model of doing work at the big two, then coming over to Image to make the money, I think is harder now than it used to be. And I think that I'm interested to see why certain creators who are successful, like Brian King Vaughan and I can't remember the artist. Is it Chang who's doing this?
I believe it's Chang, Cliff Chang.
Yeah. They could, you know, kind of like the Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey, they could continue doing this because they have a fan base that'll buy it in perpetuity, you know, relatively, especially in the collected edition format. And I'm just wondering if the ultimate success for creators is being able to do the series to 30 issues like you want instead of having to do it because you need to make a paycheck. You know what I mean? Like, I think obviously Saga's made enough money and they've decided to stop at 103 or whatever it is. But it's almost like they've reached the next level, which is like, you can decide you want to quit when you want to quit instead of like, this is how I have to make my money. You know, because I think the creators at this level know that they're going to, or at least they have a reasonable expectation that they can start new properties, or they have residuals coming in from all their other properties. You know what I mean?
Well, and I think Brian K. Vaughan is in an interesting position because on the trades list, he did the best of all the writers.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was not just did he have Paper Girls, but he also had Saga, all 9 volumes of that, plus a compendium or so on the list. I think there was even a volume of Why the Last Man on the list. So he's got a lot of material that is just continuing to earn him money. So that gives him a lot more freedom to go do some stuff than other people who are living maybe a little more paycheck to paycheck or project to project. And that's great, but like you said, you got to have that level of success to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, it's kind of like one of those things where, I mean, look at for Robert Kirkman, a lot of Skybound stuff, you could clearly tell. Now, I know we don't have an insight into their actual contracts, but you know that he was using when he was getting that up and running, and he was, you know, he funds a lot of those initial series in Skybound from his money from Walking Dead. And some of those, if you look at the copyright pages, some of those deals are kind of like the Top Cow deal where they get a part of the copyright. So you know that there's probably a page rate or something like that. And he was using all the, you know, the hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars that Walking Dead was throwing off in various aspects of collected editions, TV rights and all that to fund a lot of that stuff. And, you know, when you have that kind of money, you can take chances, you can explore other formats, you can keep something going if you want to tell a story that, you know, may not be great in single issue form, but you can, you know, subsidize that with other series. You know, the creators at the level like Jason Aaron, you know, Brian K. Vaughan, those kind of people, Hickman, they just have money coming in from previous projects that allow them to do that, you know, and they can kind of, they've reached that steady state where they have the underlying income to do it.
Oh, absolutely. Things like Die never would have happened.
Oh,
if
yeah.
Kirkman didn't have all the success and the money coming in from Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And Invincible went really long, but it wasn't anywhere near the success that Walking Dead was. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Kirkman was able to do all kinds of projects. Astounding Wolfman, was it Super Dinosaur or whatever, and a few things like that. because he wanted to, not because he was there, hey, I've got to go earn some money to put food on the table.
Exactly. And, you know, the honest truth is that's why we see so many image series, which start out as like, you know, ongoing series, and then they either get converted to a 4 to 6 issue miniseries, or volume one comes out and then you don't see any more issues for another 6 to 18 months, is because they have to go take other jobs to make, you know, make ends meet, or they are waiting for the actual payments from Image for the collected editions to build up enough money to pay the artist to do the next volume. You know what I mean? A lot of the beginning creators are bootstrapping it in the real sense. And we talk all the time about, you know, the direct market, at least from the comic store owner's perspective, is the thing that kills series momentum is stuff not coming out on time. But it's this catch 22 where the business model is so broken for the creators. A lot of them on the indie side, they literally have to have just money to put out another product, but that sometimes can lag. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because you've got to have created the story, written the story, given it to the artist, paid the artist, depending on the deal. Maybe they're willing to do it, you know, on contingent of getting paid later, but that's kind of a losing proposition for everybody, including the artist, a lot of times. And, you know, with Kirkman, he started out in that boat having to do that without that steady income before he built up Walking Dead, and that was not one of his first properties. You need Battle Pope and a few others.
Mm-hmm.
But that is one of the things where the market favors the already successful, because they've got more resources, they've got more credibility, they've got more market awareness. And that's why it's hard for these other publishers and creators to really get a foot in the door and climb up that success ladder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to see people like Kirkman having had that success. It's nice to see Brian K. Vaughan able to leverage that success as well. And hopefully we'll get more and more of this over time, but given the shorter lifespan of titles by and large, it seems less and less likely.
Yeah. No, and that's where you see this cycle, and there's only so many creators that can kind of extend series past 1, 2, 3 trades, even 2 trades sometimes. And you know, like we've talked about in the past, The old success story used to be 60 issue run at Vertigo, right? Now it's a 30 issue run at Image if you're lucky, you know?
Yeah. I mean, titles lasting. I need to do an analysis on how long the average titles are lasting. And I haven't decided if I should be doing the numbers based on when the title launches or when they start, or maybe both.
The thing I think would be so hard for you on that is I almost wondered, you'd have to split it between the big two and everything else, because the big two renumber and revolume and rename everything so often just because they want to get that number one with all the variant covers, because they bank that money. And it's almost like, especially for Marvel, it almost seems like all they care about is making as much money on the first 2 or 3 issues, hoodwinking the retailers into buying as many as possible. And then it literally is like, we've factored into our spreadsheet that all the money we make selling 200,000 copies of the first issue of a series we know we'll realistically only sell 18,000 copies is what's going to pay for the next 10 until we do it again, you know?
Well, there's a lot baked into what you just said there. One, I do think a lot of publishers, not just Marvel, are going with the, you know, let's make as much money as we can on the first issue to have it effectively subsidize the continuation of the series through 8 issues or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first issues of a Dynamite book, what was it? It was one of the ones that had all of the street-level characters like the Shadow and stuff like that teaming up. The first issue sold like 80,000, and the next few issues sold like in the few thousand range or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those where they pulled out all the stops, had a really great first issue, and then cut as many corners, it felt like, as they could on the subsequent issues so they could afford to get it out with what they made on the first. So, I mean, that's a tactic a lot of publishers use. But the other thing you kind of tossed out there was how Marvel and DC, more so Marvel, are relaunching the same property over and over again. But that, to me, is the difference between a new title and a new property. Typically, when we get a new title at Image, it is a new property.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they'll go back to the well and do another volume of an existing property, but more often than not, it's new creators, new thing, whatever. Flip side, over at Marvel, how many times are they going to relaunch a new version of X-Men or Uncanny X-Men or, you know, some variation thereof? So it's not a new property. It's maybe a new random assortment of mutants or whatever, but it's another X-Men book. So tracking how long a property sticks around is much, much harder. but I've done enough data cleaning on the data I've got from Diamond to be able to take a stab at, here is a title and it ran for so many consecutive issues. Now, it may have replaced an almost identical one or be replaced by an almost identical one for the same property, but that's harder to track, you know. But I could at least say a title that the average length of a title that started, say, first quarter of 2016 was so long versus, you know, second quarter of 2016. I just need to find the time to do that analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm willing to bet the lifespan drops significantly over time. Now, DC is a different ball of wax, and I think it's a matter of there are a couple of months where those titles tend to last years, followed on either or surrounded by either side of much lower lifespans because of all the stuff that launched for the New 52 or relaunched for Rebirth or something like mm-hmm. that. Versus most months are just going to have, hey, here's some miniseries. It was only expected to go six issues.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But the way that ripples onto the trade side is it's gotten to where it's hard to have a series of trades that goes for any number of volumes because the source material doesn't, you know? It's mm-hmm. it's getting to where at DC, we're getting up to like volume 10 or something like that of some of these things, like Flash after Rebirth. But part of that is because they were coming out, after Rebirth, because it was coming out so fast. Mm-hmm. But most other stuff, they're going to revolume it even if the underlying title hasn't changed because a new creative team change, or again, trying to go for that new number one on the trade side.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's an interesting aspect of it. You know, Marvel has a very well-organized omnibus program that they do for various things. And in the past, a lot of that material was pretty easy to organize because there was decent chunks of runs. And now it's going to be interesting as they redo things and they move creators around more frequently. How are they going to break their omnibuses up? Or are they going to be less of them? Now, for someone like Jason Aaron and his Thor run, even though they had like six different titles for his Thor, they could still do a Jason Aaron by Thor, almost like Walt Simonson. You know, that version, there's going to be a big fat omnibus for Jason Aaron. But when you look at what's included in the book, there's going to be six different titles because you know how they renumbered and renamed that thing over and over and over.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how they go forward. Whereas before, you know, like Marvel does do omnibuses of like, you know, creators that were, did, you know, epic runs on things, but they also did like omnibuses that were certain particular series, like the Clone Saga for Spider-Man and things like that. And it'll be interesting to see if, because there's just less of those type of long runs for particular stories now, if it's just going to become more of like, here's John Byrne's this, here's Jason Aaron's this, here's, you know, just like a creator that there's enough knowledge about that someone's going to pick that up, even if it's across like six different renumbers and restarts.
I really wish I had writer artist information going further back because I've only got that going to about 2008. But man, I'd love to have a data set that had for all of the different titles and stuff in the past, when they came out, who did them and stuff, to do an analysis to see, because it feels like back in the day, Byrne would have epic runs on things, Peter David would have epic runs on things, other creators would have epic runs on things. So you'd have one batch of titles at the various publishers like that, but then you'd have a few others where you would have like the Clone Saga or some other, you know, really epic event going on through the Mutant books or the Spider-Man books or the Justice League books or whatever, done by a whole bunch of creators, but there was still like the Superman, kind of the triangle era under Mike Carlin's editorship where you had a ton of creators, but it was a consistent story across all the titles in an epic run of a sort.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if those kinds of either epic creator runs or multi-creator runs, it feels like that just doesn't happen or last as long these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
But really, to do that kind of analysis, I'd need not only that information on writer-artist, but also some other sort of information denoting when was there kind of a sharp left turn in the story, whether the creator changed or not. Because it's one thing to have a really smooth handoff from one creator to another, like happened at one time on Daredevil after Bendis was leaving.
Mm-hmm.
There's another thing to have, you know, every six issues or whatever, you know, Nightwing's got a new location, a new status quo or whatever, until the next, you know, writer comes on board.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think both of those things, creative shifts on the creative team and also just radical story shifts, those are things that push people out of the reading habit. And it's hard enough to get them to bridge the gap from issue to issue. I think on a trade-to-trade basis, that's even harder.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's one thing to say, you know what, I'm going to plunk down the $3 or $4 to see if this first issue by the new creator is any good, versus do I want to put down $16 to $20 or $30 for the next trade to see if it's any good?
Yeah. Well, and the price points just keep moving up in a lot of ways, and the companies are just giving people more reasons to move on, you know, especially with the fact that nowadays there's infinite amounts of entertainment available to people with streaming and everything coming online and gaming and everything else. I think, you know, unfortunately, comics are for your time versus dollar. You know, that's a hard sell versus what people have access to nowadays.
Oh, absolutely. And even if you were to go with, there's always been a lot of entertainment, but this is for a particular, you know, genre or whatever. This genre, be it, and I don't want to lump everything in superheroes, but superheroes are really well represented on TV and movies these days. And a lot of the other genres we're getting, which are either the post-apocalyptic or the supernatural or the procedural sort of stuff, those are really well represented elsewhere too.
Mm-hmm.
So it used to be, growing up, for me to get a really good superhero story, it's either get up at the crack of dawn and watch the Saturday morning cartoons, which are no longer on the air, or, you know, catch the Batman animated series when it was on, or the one superhero TV, you know, primetime TV show, if there was one on. Now, there's so many of them coming out, I'm behind the equivalent of a couple of seasons on some of this stuff. It's just, they're, by having that level of cultural success, it's causing them to have a certain amount of financial failure, because they're failing to be able to compete with their own properties and other mediums.
Yeah, no, it's the cycle that they're caught in, right? It's almost like they've made their bed, now they have to lie in it, you know?
Absolutely. But there's an irony on a lot of people considering themselves fans of Marvel Comics, even though in many cases they've probably never read one, much less purchased one. Maybe if Marvel's lucky, they've gotten on the Digital Comics Unlimited bandwagon or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had a few people over the years at work, you know, be told, oh yeah, I was told, I really got to go talk to you. You're another comic fan too. I'm really big into comics. Oh, what do you read? Oh, I just watch the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. And I get it, because again, there's plenty of movies, plenty of TV shows, and if you want stories in the Marvel Universe, there's some excellent ones out there. But if that level of cultural success translated at all into comics, we should be seeing somewhere near the top of the list an Avengers title of some sort. Matter of fact, I'm scanning down the list, and the top one of any Marvel Cinematic Universe character that I'm seeing, I think, is Captain America Volume 2, Captain of Nothing at rank 32 with 1,813 units. You could argue a few above it, War of the Realms for Venom, although that's the Venom stuff, not the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Mm-hmm.
I take it back. Immortal Hulk Volume 4 is at rank number 5, 4,785 units. But the fact that I had to go look a little bit and it wasn't, oh my God, it's, of course, it's right there. It's the Avengers title. It's front and center.
Yeah.
Says something about how successful the movies were and how little it's translated to readership.
Well, and just like when the Matt Fraction and David Aja Hawkeye was the, you know, kind of big two book of the year for a year and kind of like spawned Styles and all that, I think the honest truth is the Immortal Hulk, this run by Al Ewing, is kind of like something they could never have expected. They're not going to be able to duplicate it. It's just going to be one of those one-off runs that does really well. And I'm not saying it's not really well written. I actually like it a lot, but it's just like one of those shooting star things. Just like Robert Kirkman has never been able to reproduce Walking Dead. And I'm not saying it's as successful as Walking Dead. I'm just saying for a big two book, how inconsistently they can actually have breakout hits. It's just one of those ones they rolled the dice and they got lucky, you know?
Yeah, I think one of the differences is Immortal Hulk is actually selling really well.
Yeah.
Whereas Hawkeye was more of a critical success.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But either way, you're having some level of some sort of success.
Yeah.
And you're right. Immortal Hulk, I don't think they were thinking, you know what, this is going to sell just through the roof.
I know, right?
It was the right take at the right time by the right creative team. It wasn't working for me. I got off the book, but other people are loving it. So that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, and it's one of those things where, you know, every couple of years or once a year, you'll have something that just organically works and it does well based on the material. And hey, that's great. The unfortunate reality is in this industry is they're few and far between, you know, and that's the unfortunate part.
But do they have to be so few and far between?
That is a good question.
You know, it's been 15 years since we've seen Walking Dead start going up the charts. There's been time for some other creator to have some other property that really kind of caught on that way. Mm-hmm. And you could argue maybe Chew, maybe Saga, maybe this, maybe that, but none that are unarguably that level of success. And that's the part that it seems like, I mean, when we only had, you know, top 300 comics or whatever, now we've got the top 500, and we've had that for quite some time. There's no shortage of material coming out that somebody else couldn't have just dumb-lucked their way into this, and that's a horrible way to put it, because there are some people out there that are just crazy talented, just having a hard time finding an audience. And I think part of it is the amount of material coming out is making it hard to find an audience. You know, when you've got, you know, 20 books coming out a week versus the 200 we've got now, very different playing field. You know, I remember as a kid getting into things like DN Agents and Crossfire and some other stuff from Eclipse because there wasn't enough Marvel DC material to you know, quench my thirst for these kinds of stories. Now there's more than enough.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a weird time we live in.
Yeah, it's just the fracturing of all the different audiences and, you know, the microization basically of everyone. Yeah, you know, it's kind of like the double-edged sword. There's a book for everyone now, but now if you could only have, everyone is only reading 5 books or, you know, to the point where can you sustain it on that number, you know?
Well, it's funny because I think there's the fracturing of the audience that way and more narrow casting than broadcasting, if you will. But I think there's also a fracturing of the properties to a large degree.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we look at rank number 9, we've got Batman Nightwalker, the graphic novel from DC Inc. And that's not the classic Batman. It's a different take on Batman. Maybe not a radically different one. I actually haven't read that, so I don't know. But the DC Inc. version of these characters and the DC Zoom version of these characters, it's not the same as the mainstream DC Universe versions. You know, the versions they've done of the Super Sons is fairly different. And there's nothing right or wrong about the different takes, but by having those different takes, it's like, well, almost by definition, I'm going to like one better than the other. It's just kind of weird.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
So there were a few things that struck me as a little odd this time around, or different or unusual, let's say. Rank number 12, and also down at rank number 34. 12, we've got the DC Poster Portfolio by Jim Lee. Not that often we see a poster book doing so well. And then down at rank 34, we got the DC Poster Portfolio by Frank Cho.
Interesting.
I didn't look to see if there were other poster ones, but 2 was plenty. Both of those are great artists, so I get it.
Now, are these like oversized just collections of posters that they've sold in the past, or are these literally like books of posters? you know what I'm asking? Is this like an art book that's just like 8x12, or is this like a normal size hardcover that just has basically shrunken down versions of the posters they sold people through the catalog?
The Jim Lee one is 12x18 on heavy cardstock paper, and the pages are easy to pull out and are suitable for framing.
Ah, okay.
And same thing with the Frank Cho one.
Does it tell you what the page count on that is? Because if that's true, that production level for $24.99 is actually not too bad if that's good quality. Now, if it's only like 8 pages, you know, 8 posters, then I don't know. But
how about 20?
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I'm just not into that, so I wouldn't spend a dollar on that. But you know what I mean? Like, it's just not my thing. It's the same thing with like some of the sketchbooks and stuff that I just find utterly not in my wheelhouse, so I wouldn't be interested in at 99 cents even. But it's interesting that price point and what the product is.
For $25 to get 20 of these things, you could, you know, pull out, put up on the wall or whatever.
And those are good size. You know, that's a decent size.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
I would almost think that you'd want to pull it apart and put them out because that size on your bookshelf will screw everything up in terms of lining stuff up.
You would need a higher shelf on that one than most other books.
Yeah.
But presumably that's where the shelf you're putting like your absolutes and omnibuses on anyways.
Yeah, I definitely have it. It's funny, people like me who collect the collected editions in different formats. I definitely have. I have to, whenever I buy a new bookcase, I have to make sure it's adjustable so I can move shelves up and down depending on the size. And then also, you know, most bookshelves have a couple fixed weight bearing versus the other ones where you kind of can pin them in. And I'm always like, well, this is where all the heavy stuff has to go. So I have to line everything up. So there's definitely some thinking when it comes to this.
Absolutely. Whenever I move to a new place, bookcases and sturdy ones and adjustable ones are definitely something I'm going to have to do some serious looking into. Because some of the bookcases I've got now, I've had, well, for the 20 or so years I've been in this house, and I had them before then, and some of them are starting to sag just a little in a few places, because these books are not light.
Mm-hmm.
That's, definite first world problems, I guess.
Yeah, so those are interesting items. I had definitely skipped over those in the previews. I didn't see those when they were solicited.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly which covers they're doing, but... I mean, that's I don't say free money for DC, but pretty much is.
Now, here's an interesting question for you. Do you think that these were solicited in the now, obviously, DC having its own section of previews now, they probably were. But I was almost wondering if I don't remember seeing them because they were solicited in the back half past the comics in the like collectible stuff.
No, if you look at the order or the item codes, the Jim Lee one was Jan 19/06/71. So obviously okay. January 2019. But the 0671, it was right there in the DC section, probably gotcha. Near the back of it with the other trades and such.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But, you know, if they did one of these for, actually two of these for Alex Ross, one with the various Justice League covers he did of the characters and one for the JSA mm-hmm. ones, I'd be down for that.
Yeah, no, I could see, yeah, definitely certain artists being worth it. Like, I think I'd be interested in the Darwin Cook one.
Yeah. Well, and if Boom were to do something like that for the different either lineups of the Power Rangers or different Power Rangers themselves, I'd be down for that. Mm-hmm. So, but this is, again, to your point, you know, when did they solicit this? It's so easy to look this stuff over and just miss it in previews every month.
I mean, that catalog gets thicker every month, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
When I was thinking, I was like, oh, well, they're pulling out the DC, they're pulling out the Marvel, the catalog will be thinner. Nope, not thinner at all.
Well, at one point, and this is a digression, but it's relevant on the trade side here. At one point, they had cut back on the number of previously offered things, like trades and such. Mm-hmm. And that cut the number of items in the order form literally by like 1,000 or two. But that's crept back in. And I find it a little frustrating because like when I'm either parsing the files or just manually going through like the text file for previews, you hit that section where it's like, okay, we've got this one volume of whatever, and then here's the last, you know, 30 related things by that creator or something.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of non-new material in previews every month, which is good, so it's continually available, and I've certainly availed myself of that at times, but that's why we've got 5,000 to 6,000 items every month sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's a ton of stuff. One thing I noticed is we've got some of the War of Realms trade paperbacks. We've got the Venom one at rank number 30 doing 1,903 units. The New Agents of Atlas at rank 48 doing 1,428 units. The Spider-Man Deadpool one down at rank 65 doing 1,220 units. And then I think we had reorder activity for the actual War of Realms trade itself. Only doing 544 units, but again, that's reorder. I think it was on the list last month.
Mm-hmm.
So War of Realms is doing okay.
Yeah, you know, I think with the big two, I think it's going to be harder and harder for them to have long tail sales for their events because they just have so many events now. They quote unquote, I know that they say in their marketing that this is going to matter this time, but the obvious fact that they do it all the time and reset the character and the status quo all the time. I think people finally have come around to realize, no, some people I know just skip certain events, whereas they used to feel like they'd miss out on something if they did that in the past. And I think unless they have, you know, every once in a while, like an Infinity Gauntlet will come around and that'll be an evergreen, you know, selling for a while. But I think you're going to get to a point where just a lot of this stuff, it's only going to sell for the first couple of months that it's out, and then you're going to have it fade into the background. Now, obviously, that's probably a good hedge to have the Marvel Unlimited. So if you can build up enough of those readers, you're getting the money from them all the time as people work through the history in the backlist. But I think a lot of these constant sales they're expecting aren't going to be there in the future, because there's just people just jump on and off titles so often, and there's so much coming out, people don't even know it existed. You know, it's just, I think it's going to be harder and harder to move some of this material.
I think that's some of it. I think another part of it is what constitutes an event is less clear.
Yeah, that's true too.
I mean, I'm just skimming through the DC listings right now, and I'm seeing a handful of things that I would consider event or other kind of notable potential evergreenish sort of things. We've got Flashpoint, Kingdom Come, Crisis on Infinite Earths, plus the Crisis on Infinite Earths 35th Anniversary Deluxe Edition. So we got the trade and a hardcover. Watchmen, Heroes in Crisis. So, again, I think some of it comes down to how, I mean, Dark Knight Metal, I would consider an event, but maybe not Dark Days Road to Metal, or what was the other side story to Dark Knight's Metal. So I do think there are some events that are going to continue to have legs like that, but it's got to be ones that are more hardcore events than just, well, you could consider it an event, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to say, you know, Civil War or whatever versus something that was just a X-Men event or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I think part of it is because they've done so many of these sorts of events that they all kind of blur together and stuff. And it, when you've got something that they're pushing as if it's an event and it doesn't sell as if it's an event, because it's not a line-wide kind of a thing that's got that level of push, that kind of devalues the actual events. And that's where I think they're getting themselves into trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, I would consider certainly House of M an event, because that spanned beyond just the mutants, although not much further beyond. But like Spider-Geddon, Spider-Verse, would you consider those events or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like, especially with the title sprawl within certain, you know, Spider-Man universe is a good example. There's so many titles now that they become their own little universe. You know what I mean?
But
and
yeah.
So you're right. They're having their own little inter-title crossover. But like you said, it sometimes the storylines have nothing to do with anything else. And, you know, for me, I mean, this is just an aspect of superhero comics that you have to accept or don't accept. I sometimes find reading them boring because I know that nothing serious is going to happen. And I get that, you know, they're characters that these companies have billions of dollars on. They're not going to kill them off. They're not going to decapitate Spider-Man and then 2 months later pretend that he comes back fine. You know, I just have to accept that and read different comics for if I want something different. You know what I mean? But at the same time, it lessens my enthusiasm for it. And like you said, that things get so siloed now that it isn't an event. I can't even say anymore.
The funny thing is, part of what I really loved about Avengers Infinity War and Avengers Endgame, the movies, mm-hmm. was that was an event in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they pull in so many characters, do so much stuff, and there was a clear before and after of those things.
Yeah.
So that kind of aspect of comic book events I can enjoy, but I'm also at the point where, you know, I sat out War of Realms, starting to sit out some of these other things because they've fractured their universe so much and their storytelling so much, because in my mind, sometimes they're playing more towards this trade audience than the individual comic book audience I am a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're coming at this from very different vantage points, and neither one's better or worse, but you read more on the trade side. So I think that colors your perspective in one way, where mine is coming at it from a different perspective, having read the stuff in individual issues, sometimes a month apart or more, depending. And again, both have advantages and disadvantages. Neither's better or worse, but you wind up seeing things, I think, very differently.
Yeah.
And I think events have to be one of the more pronounced aspects of that, because I can see it weaving in, out, or around or through various titles I'm reading. Whereas I imagine from your perspective, it's more of a kind of dropping a big rock in a small pond all at once.
Yeah. Well, and the other interesting thing is one of the nice aspects for me about reading trades is I get to use you guys as the beta testers. And I know this, I don't mean this to be an insult. When you guys do your weekly reviews or you do your reviews and I read other people's reviews as well for an event, you know how when they do an event and they do a line-wide event, they'll try and have all these like attached series or subsequent, you know, little side stories or whatever. I listen to other people's reviews and they go, oh, this is not good. This is like just filler and things like that. So I'm like, good, I'll just read the 6-issue main series. I'll only pay for that. And then all that other stuff, I don't have to worry about, because you guys, the comics community in general, told me that it was fluff and just the company trying to, you know, strip mine people for money. So I can avoid all that. And I just read the collected edition of the trade and I get what I need or what I want from it. And I, you know, I can avoid all the other stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I think makes the trade list here so interesting, is it's in some respects almost a doubly curated list.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only are the retailers, this is, you know, what they've ordered to bring into their store, so they're curating it that way, but it's also curated both in terms of what the people say they want as trades and what the people who read the comics thought about it, that's getting filtered both by the retailers and those readers of the trades saying, you know what, I didn't hear anything good about this, I'm going to pass, or I heard great stuff, I'm going to get.
Yeah.
You know, whenever we see the House of X, Powers of X collection, it will do well because not only did it sell well on the comic side, making retailers more prone to get it, but it had really good word of mouth, making readers and retailers more prone to get it.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting you say that, because also I have learned through trial and error that I don't like reading Jonathan Hickman in single issues. I only read Jonathan Hickman in collected edition and almost hardcover edition. So like I read East of West in his the two trade collected hardcovers. And I read all of his stuff in that format. Now, I really like Jonathan Hickman, but I totally understand why people don't. I can absolutely see the flaws in his writing that people talk about, but I love the way he writes and the in-depth and the almost kind of arrogance with which he writes. I don't mind that, but I understand why people, you know, people have a problem with that. But I also see why people who would read him in single issues can find him infuriating. So, but when I read 12 issues at a time, it's great for me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There are some readers and writers that they mix better in some ways than others.
Yeah.
There's some stuff where I like having a pausing point between installments to kind of digest it and think about it that I wouldn't get if I read it all in a straight sitting. And there are other times where it's like, damn it, I need more to have something to mull over.
Yeah. And it's kind of like one of those things where I understand that I'm a Jonathan Hickman fan, so I'm willing to wait for, you know, for the series to be almost completed or him to be putting out the hardcover versions, and then I'll purchase those versions of it and I'll get this huge satisfying chunks, the world building. I'll be able to keep all of the details that he packs into it in my head because I'm reading it all at once. You know what I mean? So I get the idealized version of him, the full effect, and knowing what to look for with his writing. I pay attention to the details. I, you know, since I'm reading it all in one sitting or a couple sittings, I don't lose track of characters. I don't lose track of threads. You know, a lot of times people are like, oh, he thinks he's too clever for his own good. He is too clever for his own good, but if you read it in one go, you get it, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I've read a couple of stories of his and other people's where they introduce something in the second issue that's pivotal in the sixth, which if that's a half hour apart for your reading or whatever, that's not too bad.
No, not at all.
If it's 3 months apart or 4 months apart or a year apart, forget it.
Yeah.
Because, well, you forgot it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I understand the frustrations that the single issues readers have, but I just don't experience some of them just because the way I interact with the material is so different. And you know what? There are certain aspects of the hobby that I am not necessarily part of because of the choices I make. The week to week and the day to day that people can go online and chat with each other or go into the shop and chat with each other about things like that. I miss that because I'm in general reading 6 months to a year lag. You know what I mean? That's just the reality of how things are published. Now with Marvel Unlimited, you know, I can read single issues, but I'm still 6 months behind or things like that. But for me, I've always been more of a, I read comics to consume the content and consume the stories than about having the nitty gritty discussion about going back and forth about, oh, was that a good Captain America story? Were the choices they made good? That's never been something that's been a draw for me. Whereas some people literally the reason they like comics is that camaraderie and that ability to have the community discussion, you know, in the message boards, in the trenches, things like that. But that for me has not been one of the big draws for me. Me, the big draw is to be able to consume the stories and being able to say, hey, that was a great story. I really liked it. I'm going to move on to the next thing. You know,
I know exactly what you're talking about. I tend to lean in that direction too. But it's also one of the reasons why, you know, I always try to prod people to, you know, I love that people use the forum and the Slack channel to have discussions on the in and outs of stories as they're happening and stuff like that. I totally support that. But I also totally support a lack of spoilers for those of us who may be a little behind on our reading or waiting for the trade or whatever, to not have that spoiled inadvertently. Now, if somebody says, hey, I know about this, do you mind if I tell you? And you say, hey, that's fine, that's cool, that's great. But if somebody's saying, hey, I haven't partaken of the story yet, you know, hold off. It's respectful to do that. It's respectful to the person who hasn't read the stuff yet. It's respectful to the creator of the material. I was at Dallas Fan Days recently, and they were talking about one of the things one of the guests did years ago. And the moderator's like, what? It's 29 years old and you haven't seen it yet? Come on. It's not a spoiler. It's 29 years old. And I'm sitting there thinking, there are people in the room who are not 29 years old.
Yeah.
I'm willing to bet none of them watched that live when it aired. So it's new to them, potentially. Maybe this is the first time they're even realizing that actor was on that show, you know, kind of a thing. So there are ways you can talk about some of this without, you know, hey, the butler did it kind of, you know, starting of a conversation. And it's, again, some people don't get bothered by spoilers, but it's one of those things that ultimately we're all reading these stories for the journey of the story. Whether we do it in single issues, do it as trade, whatever, do it online, digitally, what have you. And to have that kind of ripped away from us by a bullet point summary that you know has none of the storytelling finesse or whatever to it always annoys me.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
You know, because if you look at some of the stuff on the list, we've got things that are older material than the age of listeners of this podcast, you know, and I guarantee that because I'm sure somewhere on this list is going to be like one of those Marvel masterworks reprinting something from, you know, the golden age of comics or something. So even the oldest of the listeners, you know, are younger than that. Now, granted, they've hopefully had time to read all this, but they're printing all of this stuff so we can read it. Not so somebody can just say, yeah, you know, so-and-so killed so-and-so and that's it. But that's just, that's one of those things that there's so much material here that just on this list of like 500 and some odd things, I'm willing to bet there's something that every one of the listeners would really enjoy. Now, it may take a little while to go find the right thing for each listener or whatever, but it's cool that there's that diversity of material out. But the downside of that diversity of material is think how long it would take to read just everything on this list this month.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it's a staggering amount. So it's nice because that means there's always something new to read. But that's again, the other thing they're kind of competing with. There's just so much out there.
Mm-hmm.
So what else looked interesting to you on the list?
You know, I when we talked a little bit earlier about kind of some of the big series winding down at Image, I wanted to highlight that at rank 4, we still have Monstrous. The next volume, volume 4, bringing in really solid sales. I think it's basically become, in the absence of Saga and Walking Dead, their kind of best-selling series, at least on the trade side. I can't really speak for Annette Paper Girls winding down and East to West winding down and I think Black Science winding down. You know, just kind of like the series, you know, the last 5 years for the big-name creators, there's been a number of relatively long-term series, and a lot of those are winding down. And I think Monstrous is kind of like taking up the mantle for most successful current Image series, considering that Saga is gone. So I wanted to highlight that the next volume in that series is still being a strong seller, and you see continued sales of the previous volumes too.
How much of a risk do you think that poses for Image? Do you think they have really strong titles that they've announced that are starting to come out to replace those things?
That is a very good question, because I think, like I spoke with about you earlier in this show, it's become very hard for the people that don't have the name recognition to get a series off the ground for anything than a trade or two. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what Image does to prevent itself from becoming not necessarily like a vanity press for just the people who can be successful, who have already built their name. You know, I think that they're going to have to invest more time and more money, which is also problematic because of their business model in terms of the flat fee. So how much money do they really have to throw at things like advertising and getting someone to, you know, stick? What are they going to do to make sure that they don't just become the place where you go once you've established yourself? You know, is it going to become, you can't break someone that's new? Because I think they've really had a problem with that for the last couple of years.
It's funny because I agree with you entirely there. They've got kind of a definite crop rotation. Titles come in, stay for a bit, go out, rinse, repeat. And a lot of them, you're right, are from those already known successful creators that have an audience built in. And it almost seems like for Image to have a really solid long-term success strategy there, it would behoove them to partner with like Comics Experience, which has partnered with SourcePoint Press. Comics Experience is basically an educational place of here, learn how to write, draw, all these kinds of things, how to put together a comic. It's, I'm blanking on the guy's name. I've been to his panels numerous times. He was an editor at Marvel. He knows his stuff. But he's gotten it to where SourcePoint Press will actually, you know, help print some of these books that they get done. And that's great, but who knows SourcePoint Press from anything kind of a deal. Mm-hmm. Whereas if Image had that kind of training, mentorship program, getting people ready to be printed through them, that could be a win-win for everybody.
Absolutely.
And again, I think what Comics Experience is doing is doing great as it is. I think SourcePoint Press is a great way for them to go print the stuff. But it does seem like Image needs a better feeder system and grooming system for stuff coming in. Because there's some good stuff coming in, but it's not ready for long-term success sometimes.
Yeah, and I wonder if you know, they're going to get to a point where they have – I mean, and they made – this will have to be a decision that the founders or whoever's in who's in control now – and I know it's a little different when you say control because a lot of these things are siloed and they're kind of separate publishing things. But they may have to make a decision, you know, are we going to start – in it is the best – long-term decision for Image to try and really support and get some of these series off the ground, or are we going to become basically like a almost like a co-op where the people that have their little siloed studios, they can put out what they want as long as they can afford to pay for it, and that'll just become what it is, almost like a shared working space? Because you can see it going either way, right? Like, you know, as long as you know, Spawn wants to be published, as long as Savage Dragon, as long as Kirkman has money to fund his little studio, they'll put out whatever they want. But if they can never get people who don't have the name recognition and the money past the first trade or two, that pipeline is going to dry up. You know, at a certain point, people are going to realize, if I bring my idea here and I can never get it off the ground, yes, it's great to own 100% of the IP, but if I can never get it off the ground, it may be better to go to Dark Horse. It may be better to go to another place and give them a certain percentage of it, as long if they're going to give me a page rate and kind of help me build my career. If Image isn't careful, they're going to lose the idea that you can build your career there, you know?
Absolutely. Andy Schmidt was the guy I was thinking of, former editor at IDW and Marvel and stuff. He runs Comics Experience and helps train people for that longer haul kind of a deal. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a story that's great. It's more than just can you write it? Can you market it? Can you get, again, your foot in the door and not just have the few issues come out and we'll see what happens after that?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think if you've got a property these days you want to go publishing comics, there's a ton of stuff you've got to think about in terms of who do you want to partner with, if anyone. You know, do you want to try to do it yourself? We've seen some people have great success doing that. You know, the Terry Moores and stuff like that. We've seen other people who started that way and then partnered, like with IDW. Tom Zoller is one of those. He had his own publishing and is starting to have his stuff, or has had his stuff through IDW for a while, and that seems to work well for him. Mm-hmm. Others have gone to Image and had success there. Others have gone to Image and get an issue or two or a series, a few issues out, and that's about it, for a variety of reasons. Not faulting either the creators or Image on that. Or do you partner with a studio that wants a little more ownership, but will take a more active role in getting the property to have legs for the longer term?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the two guys who were behind Stargate SG-1, the TV show, did a 4-issue series at Dark Horse for Dark Matter. And it was basically, let's take the pilot episode and do it as a 4-issue comic and see what happens. And Dark Horse printed it, and Dark Horse was one of the people behind, or companies behind, getting the show on the air for 3 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes down to what do you want, what works for you, and what are your strengths and weaknesses, and what do you need somebody else to shore up, and what are you willing to trade in exchange for that? Because 100% ownership in a property that's going nowhere isn't as valuable as, say, 51% ownership in something that's going really far.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that'll become the... You know, that's, I think, going to be their issue if they're, you know, if you, if they get into this cycle where the only people that can have books that go, you know, 30 to 60 issues are the people that are already established, I think that's a, you know, that's worrisome, you know. So,
but even if they get to the point where they've got an Image 6-issue runs that are strong but need a little while before they're ready for the next 6-issue run, they could do what the Sci-Fi Channel did at one point, where they had the Sci-Fi Friday Night. Half the year Friday Night had shows A, B, and C. The other half of the year it had, you know, D, E, and F. But throughout the year, you always had a really great Friday Night lineup.
Uh-huh.
It's just, is it, you know, Stargate and Doctor Who, or is it Battlestar Galactica and whatever else they had on at the, you know, Torchwood or something?
Mm-hmm.
So I really do think Image needs to give some thought as to how they're handling their feeder system of incoming material, how they're coaching it to where it has longer term success. Because if they get to a point where they've got a bad few rounds of titles coming out, that could, I don't say hurt their credibility, but hurt the cachet or whatever, hurt the incentive for other people to go there thinking they'll have success.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and as Image is also susceptible, you know, to the fact that they take their whole business model is on people bringing stuff to them. And so if like you said, there becomes this situation where it's like, ooh, you know, it's not as, you know, almost like at the in between the last time, you know, the last time the comics age crashed and before, you know, the Kirkman Manifesto and that being successful, where it was like, it was hard to take stuff to Image, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Back to that.
Yeah, that would be an unfortunate thing, because Image is at times, less so now, but at times it was a feeder system for new talent,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the entire industry. I mean, there was a point at which Marvel and DC were looking at, here are some up-and-coming, you know, creator-owned works that we like the work of, so let's go tap these creators to go do, you know, a title or two or more over at Image and DC, or Marvel and DC. I mean, it's just, it's one of those things where it doesn't take much for a company to go from nowhere to somewhere or somewhere to nowhere.
Yep.
And with a lot of the longer term things kind of, you know, not continuing over at Image, if they've got another round of titles that can fill the void, that's great. If they don't, that's not so good.
Yeah. It'll be worth paying attention, you know, the next couple of years to see, you know, just kind of like the average length that their average series, you know what I mean? Like, it almost would be interesting to see if we could, you know, if they put out 30 books a month, you know, how long, you know, over time, how many issues do they get to, you know?
Yeah, both in terms of how many issues do the titles get to, how long do the creators stick around? Because I'm not overjoyed, but I'm okay with a creator that does a bunch of 6-issue arcs on different titles if they're continuing producing and I like what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't demand that Rucka do one and only one property as long as he's continuing to do stuff I like to read.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that would be key in doing that kind of really proper analysis is not just how long things last, but some indication of why they ended.
Yeah.
You know, hey, it was a 6-issue run to begin with. It was supposed to end. Okay, that's fine. But if it was, hey, this is a new ongoing title and it ends after 6 every time, that's less good.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's it is one of those things where I think we're seeing shorter lifespans, more reimaginings and retries of existing material. And I think the bar you've got to get past that threshold of entry or whatever for new readers, it's harder and harder as time goes on. There's more stuff it's being compared against, more stuff it's competing with. And I think it's a competitive market out there, and it'd be nice to have it be easier for people to get in and have success.
Oh, absolutely. It's, yeah, I just, there's so many barriers to entry now at this point that I wonder, you know, it's a self-reinforcing cycle.
Yeah. It's just a question of what could be done to help out on that. And I don't know. Something needs to be done though, because we all want more titles out there that we enjoy. I think everyone can agree on that, even if they don't agree on what those titles are.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
It'd be nice if there were a couple of titles everybody agreed on, because they'd be topping the list and we'd all be happy. But diversity is a good thing as well. The other thing that'd be nice is a clear kind of a reminder of, yep, this one's ended and this one thinks it's coming back at some point, or they're taking a breather, whatever. Because there are times I'm looking at this list like, Port of Earth, it's like, I remember that. I enjoyed that. Is it coming out again after this? Are they taking a break or is it over? I don't remember.
Yeah. that's one of those series that, you know, you clearly saw that they were doing 4-issue little chunks for their, you know, to make the trades work for their business model. And I like the first two trades, so, you know, we'll see. They bring out more.
I think the third was what I was seeing on the list this time around.
Okay.
Down at rank 99, it did 880 units. But again, there's so much stuff on this list, it's easy for things to just slip past unnoticed.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of comic is one of those, it's like in a subgenre. It's not exactly like your superhero comic, so it, already the audience is limited, you know what I mean?
Is it really limited? Because that's the kind of thing I could see as a good sci-fi TV show.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'll put it this way. It's limited by the fact that there are 100,000 other comics to choose from, and they don't have a marketing budget, so yes.
There is that. I agree with that entirely. But I don't think it's limited in terms of the property itself.
Yeah, that's true.
I think these days you could do a fairly affordable TV show for that that mixes the sci-fi aspect, the kind of political aspect, and the police procedural aspects. And it could do really well, or it could totally tank. But it's something that I think stands a chance on TV.
No, I will agree with you. That is like the various aspects you just spoke to about the procedural and the way you could kind of cross genres would make it that there would have a chance that it'd have a wider audience. I agree with you there.
It just comes down to, would people actually like that mashup of genres, or would the people who would have really enjoyed the political aspect be turned off by the aliens, people who like the alien stuff be turned off by the political aspect, or vice versa? You know, is it something that got into that realm of neither fish nor fowl?
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy for something to fall into that thing where you might really like one aspect of it, but you're really turned off by another part, or the two just don't mix well for you. That it just gets awkward.
Mm-hmm.
So, ton of reorder activity lower in the list. Not surprising there. By the time we get to the bottom of the list, which actually goes to 502 units, we're down at 167 units. So that's, you know, 1 out of 10 stores got a copy of some of these things. And a lot of this is reorder activity. Not all of it is. So there are a couple of things here that just didn't get into too many stores.
Yeah.
And some of it doesn't really surprise me because I'm like, I don't know what some of these are. Others kind of does surprise me. But it's just, it's a competitive market out there. And again, this list used to be 10 items long. And oh, that's plenty. We just need the top 10. Then it was 25, then it was 50. We're now at 10 times the size of when it was 50 items long.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, I'm sure in your job, when someone tells you, oh, you know, more information is always better. And I'm sure that makes your blood pressure rise, right? Like, just because you have more input doesn't necessarily mean you get more output.
I have this discussion with people at work all of the time of, if we're going to use the data, let's store the data. If we're not, we're just paying for storage. It's like, you know, having a warehouse. Let's put everything in there. Do we really need everything?
Yeah. Well, and then, like you said, you're like, you know, we used to have the top 10, then it was the top 300. Now, with the way sales are, they give you the top 500. And when something down here in the 450 range is reorder activity of 190 units, it's like, what is that telling you? Well, you know, is it telling me that they needed to empty out their warehouse, so they blew those out? Or is it telling me there's actual demand? And quote unquote, is actual demand of 186 units demand that I care to think about? You know, more questions than answers.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because it was one of the other things I had highlighted but forgot to mention. Right before recording this afternoon, I was going through saying, geez, what am I going to talk about? And of course, the one thing I came up with, I forgot about. So, you know, there's that. But if you look at rank 31, we've got Monstrous Volume 3 Trade Paperback Reorder Activity, 1,890 units. It was at $16.99 cover price. If we filter the list to the $16.99 cover price and then look at this item, what we immediately notice when you start looking for it is that the item above it was at retail rank 48. The one below it was at retail rank 76. But mm-hmm. this one was at 258.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. I guess they discounted that heavily. That may be something they had plenty of copies out there, or some other thing. Maybe they overshipped, whatever.
Uh-huh.
But there are a number of items, and I highlighted many, but probably not all of them, where the retail ranking, which is basically the quantity rank is take the number of units, what's the top seller, the second top seller, etc. So it's the best seller by units. The retail rank is the same thing by invoiced dollars. Now, I want to stress invoiced versus retail dollars. Retail dollars is take the units, take the cover price, boom, retail dollars. Invoiced dollars is do the same thing, but take out the discount for the retailers, i.e. what did they actually pay?
Mm-hmm.
So when you've got something that is, in this case, significantly higher of a retail ranking than the surrounding items, it means the stores paid less for that material. And there's quite a few items on the list that I spotted that had this kind of a thing going on. There was that one. There was Oblivion Song, Volume 1, down at rank 107. Jupiter's Legacy, Volume 1, down at rank 193. Wicked and Divine, Volume 1, at 196. A few things from a few other publishers. DC Superhero Girl Search for Atlantis, at rank 222. Had an abnormally high retail ranking. Same with a few other things here and there. So it's interesting to note that there's some stuff that, while it did the number of units, it didn't do the corresponding number of dollars.
Yeah.
A really good example is Jupiter's Circle, Volume 1, at rank 387, $9.99 cover price. It had a retail ranking of 1,431, whereas two items above it in 1999, the retail ranking was 687, and a few items below it from Viz had a retail ranking of 692. So here's a retail ranking that was over twice what it should be.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the question is, what's going on with that?
Well, and, you know, I think that, you know, like, let's look at the Monstrous. So this month, Volume 4 came out. Maybe Image had some sort of deal for retailers to encourage them to, because they know this is one of their best sellers currently going, you know, going for them, especially with Saga on hiatus and Walking Dead on done. Maybe there was some sort of like, you know, if you order a certain amount of this, we'll give you extra off of the first three volumes, or, you know what I mean, kind of thing, where they almost like do some extra incentive to get the, because one of the things we talk about how, you know, the inverted V for longer series. Now, Monstrous is only at Volume 4, so you wouldn't necessarily see this, the pronounced V, where, you know, when the latest issue or trade comes out, you worry about having enough stock of the second and third trade. You always probably have enough stock of the first trade, but you want to have enough in the retail channel for people to continue working through the series. And every time you release a new volume, that's an option. It catches someone's eye on the shelf and they say, hey, this looks interesting. Oh, okay, where do I find Volume 1? You know what I mean? So they want to keep that channel stuffed with inventory, and maybe offering the retailers a little bit extra off keeps that encourage that volume to flow into the stores.
I agree with that. I would think it'd have a little more credibility as to being what happened if we saw the same thing on Volumes 1 and 2.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Not saying it isn't what happened. I'm just saying, you know. But when we see Jupiter's Legacy, I think we've got 1, 2, and Jupiter's Circle on here. Actually, let me filter this list to just Jupiter stuff, because there's so many things. Yeah, we've got Jupiter's Legacy, Volume 1 and 2, and Jupiter's Circle, all of which had unusually high retail rankings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mention that because there's this Project Xmas thing that Millar's doing with, he's going to bring back some property. I wonder what. And that was in the October solicits. So when I was putting together my October order, I did a quick post on the Slack channel saying, does anyone know what this is going to be? And there was a guess that it's maybe the Jupiter stuff. And I'm like, well, you know what? That's a perfectly viable guess. Not good enough for me to go pre-order something on, though. Mm-hmm. So I decided to pass on that. But it's hard to know if some of this is they uncovered a box of old stuff they just need to get rid of, or if there's actually, you know, some promotional thing they're doing to prime the pump for something.
Yeah. Oh, and it may be that, you know, just in the instance of the Monstrous Volume 3, you know, they may have printed too many for their sales estimates, and so now they need to sell down some of those copies. You know, for successful series like The Walking Dead or Saga, I'm sure that when they do initial print runs for these, you know, and they if they have enough experience and they have enough data to forecast, you know, well, yes, we can immediately sell 50,000, but if I order 200,000 from the printer, I'm going to reduce my per unit cost quite a bit, and I know that I'll eventually be able to sell these. And so I'll have much more profit per unit, but there is a carrying cost associated with stocking it in the warehouse. So you have to do that you know, cost versus, you know, profit table and look at what is it worth. You know, it's obviously not worth it to us to print 3 million, but is it worth it us to print 30,000 knowing that in the next 2 years I'm going to sell them? Well, there's a risk, but, you know, and obviously people like Kirkman can afford that risk. People like Brian K. Vaughan can afford that risk knowing that they're going to sell. But, you know, there's all these cost calculations that they're looking at.
Exactly. Exactly. Having it sitting in a warehouse somewhere is not doing you a whole lot of good if it's not selling.
Yeah. But knowing that, you know, if you see the trend lines that this is a relatively successful series, you know, maybe printing 20,000 copies instead of 10,000 can really, you know, depending on your contract with your printer, can really bring your per unit cost down. Then every time you sell one of those, it's quite a bit more profitable. If you bring your profitability from 10 to 20%, you know, per unit, you know, it's almost like this synergy thing, right? Where that's why I think some of these creators, you know, the creators, once you get established an image, if you can really turn up the machine, you know what I mean?
Well, absolutely. If I were printing another, you know, the next volume of Saga, I would print a lot.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Gonna sell over time. It's proven that.
Yeah, exactly. That proven track record. And considering relative to what is available going forward, Monstrous is a relative, not Walking Dead level, not Saga level. It's a relative proven sales track record, you know?
Well, let's talk Walking Dead for just a minute, because volume 16 of the hardcovers came out, 1,911 units at rank number 28. That's the final hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
We've got volumes 31 and 32 of the trades on the list at ranks of 105 and 174, with 32 selling more than 31. 32 sold 819, 31 sold 496. Sorry, mm-hmm. It's small print and failing eyesight. The only other Walking Dead trade on the list is the first volume down at rank 494. It too had a higher than expected retail ranking. It sold 170 copies. Now, granted, it sold all said and done like 358,245, so it's not like it's doing poorly. But the question that's coming to my mind on this is, yeah, Walking Dead was a proven seller for the longest time. It's over. It's done. At what point does it just kind of drop off the list?
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't look like it's potentially all that far from doing so.
Absolutely.
So we'll see what happens on that one. Because it's one of those things, the continuing publishing of it acts as its own advertising.
Well, and we've talked about this with Vertigo and some of their series, Out of Sight, Out of Mind. You know, even series that were, you know, evergreens, quote unquote, you know, we may have to reevaluate what evergreen means. Evergreen may now only mean a 2 to 3 year run post the end of the series. You know, obviously there will always be outliers like Watchmen, Infinity Gauntlet, things like that, that, you know, even
I think those are true evergreens. I do think there's some other term needed for those things that are temporary evergreens, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Let's look at another huge long running. Well, I shouldn't say huge long running. The Fables, right? So Fables had what 150 issues or 144 issues.
150.
Lots of single issue or 6 issue trades. Then they did the hardcovers. Now I think they've just been started to soliciting the absolutes. And or omnibuses, whichever version. And so you're going to have it reintroduced into the market. But we pretty quickly saw those reorder numbers drop off the cliff once that series was over.
Fables did actually get on the list this time. It ranked 480 for the first volume, reorder activity of 174 units.
There you go.
So, yeah, it would be interesting to see kind of how quickly the interest dries up after the title ends.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think there is some analysis to be done on that. I'd have to give some thought as to exactly what would be the most interesting to go dig around to go find. But I do think there are some things that are those true evergreens like Watchmen and stuff, but they are fewer and further between than they certainly used to be. And it'd be interesting to know how old some of those are and how frequent those are.
Mm-hmm.
I just need more time to go play around in my database, go dig that stuff out.
Always need more time, right? Always more time.
Absolutely. So tons of stuff this time around. It's just there's so much. We are seeing, I think, decent on the manga side. A lot of things low in the list, but just a lot of titles, and some of those are, you know, volume, you know, numbers going up and stuff, which is good. So it's nice to see manga doing better than it was doing at one point, because mm-hmm. at one point it kind of fell off, at least in the direct market. It was back when there was more of a mass market to support it. We look at the price points. 1999 was the most popular one in the top 300, but 999 was not that far behind it. If we look at the top 500, 999 actually takes over as the main price point, which is kind of interesting, with 1999 being the second most and a decent ways behind it. 84 of the items in the top 500 had a $9.99 price point, but only 56 had $19.99. Whereas in the top 300, 40 were at $19.99 and 38 were at $9.99. Other popular price points, $24.99, $14.99. So if we look at the $25 and under, that covers like 81.67% of the top 300 and 82.63% of the top 500. We had stuff as high as $200. Good couple of things over the you know, $75 price point or 75 and over. It was, I think we had like 10 items at that point. Mm-hmm. So we're still seeing some high ticket stuff like the Marvel's Platinum Edition slipcase that had, what did that have in it? It's got a really long blurb and doesn't tell me a whole lot as to what's is Marvel's is in there. Great, got it. Okay, it collects Marvel's 1 through 4 and that's it. Wow. For a slipcase adamantium edition thing, I would have expected a little bit more out of that. It's funny because it says adamantium edition in the description, but the title is platinum edition slipcase. So confusing.
Oh, that is weird, huh?
So yeah, we have a couple of high ticket items and stuff. I do think it's good to have the occasional, you know, coffee table book or prestige, you know, really nice edition. But I think it's also good to be having a lot more affordable things just to get more people actually reading the material than just having something to go show off.
Mm-hmm.
So anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for this month.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If you differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking the action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50.5 or excuse 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales, any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Ask Logic and English Language itself seem to work very differently there.